Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. I'm very glad to have you with us this morning. Earlier this week, the Attorney General, John Ashcroft, said that he would press members of Congress to approve this week a package of counterterrorism measures that would expand the ability of the Justice Department to place wiretaps on phones and also on computer terminals. Not all of the details have been revealed, but among other things, Ashcroft said the administration was interested in getting authority to conduct roving wiretaps that would allow law enforcement to eavesdrop on terrorist suspects who moved from phone to phone rather than eavesdropping on a specific phone. Proposals are also expected to include new powers for the Justice Department to fight money laundering, tougher penalties for people harboring terrorists. We may expect some changes in immigration law in a number of areas. People who work in the area of civil liberties have voiced real concerns about the possible changes that we're talking about here, suggesting that we ought to be very careful about the changes in law that we make because we are likely to have to live with these new laws for some time to come. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll try and explore some of the civil liberties issues that are now being raised with our guest, Michael Ratner. He is an international human rights lawyer with the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City. He is also a lecturer at Columbia School of Law in New York. He's joining us by telephone. As we talk, we certainly welcome your comments and questions. We ask only that people just try to be brief, and we do that so we can keep things moving along, getting as many people as possible. But, of course, anyone is welcome to join the conversation, ask questions, make comments. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois or Indiana. That number is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. By the way, I do want to mention, too, if you're interested in reading on various subjects that touch on human rights, our guest, Michael Ratner, does have a website with various kinds of information on there, which is at www.humanrightsnow.com. That's all as one word, so no spaces between the words. Humanrightsnow.org. So you can check that out. Mr. Ratner, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Yes.
We appreciate it. I understand that you were, someone told me that on Tuesday last week when this happened, you were out jogging?
Well, I think, I think one thing that I think is important for people to understand is Southern Manhattan is feeling, I think, probably somewhat differently than the rest of the country in the sense that everybody here has been deeply personally affected. The smoke is, only today really has it been lifted. There's signs on posts everywhere of, people who are missing. And on that particular day, many of us had either friends or acquaintances who just barely escaped with their lives or, people who were one degree away who were killed. I myself, at 8:30 in the morning, I'm only a mile or so, not even that, a half a mile from the World Trade Center, took a jog down on the West Side Highway. I'm right maybe 300 yards from the North Tower. When I look up, when I hear an explosion and I see, just a fireball coming out, I stopped, talked to construction workers, and I hadn't seen that first plane go in, but when you looked at the building, they told me it was a plane, and you saw that it was a square hit into the tower. I then stood there for about 15 minutes trying to figure out what to do and talking to people. And right then, another plane, maybe 200 yards over my head, comes right over me. I thought it might be a surveillance plane or a plane to drop water or something, showing the naivete of me and probably a lot of others at that point. And it slams right into the South Tower. At that point, I and everybody else just took off and stayed away from high buildings. I then came up on 7th Avenue where you watched and you could see a clear view of the towers as first the South Tower and then the North Tower just collapsed. I mean, everybody has stories like that down here, apart from the people who were murdered in the building.
Yeah. Well, just to turn to the topic that I wanted to try to discuss, I guess in a general way, and maybe then we can get into some specifics, what concerns you about the kind of proposals that the administration has made for new laws to give them what they believe are the tools that they need to counter terrorism?
Well, you know, I haven't made a close study, and I think none of us have seen all of the new laws. But the one thing I would say to begin with, my major concern, is that I think they already had many of the tools that they needed, at least in the short term, to be able to at least to try and stop this. Whether you can ever stop this without, you know, longer range change in the policies that are going on in the world and creating enemies is a deeper question. But in the short term, you know, if I ask myself what could they have done, I think they had the tools. And when I say that, you know, we had 3 years ago we had the bombings of the embassies in East Africa. 2 years ago or less we had the bombing of the SS Cole. We've had many incidents. And they've claimed that it's been Bin Laden all along. Whether it is or isn't, I don't know. But it doesn't seem to me that they need extra tools to be able to have disabled at least a good part of that terror network before this, if they even knew who it was. So the first question I have to ask myself is, what went wrong with our intelligence agencies? Take, for example, the two prohibitions that the CIA is talking about, the one to lift, the one on assassinations, and the one to use basically criminals as informants. Those two, those two so-called prohibitions didn't stop the U.S. from bombing Libya a few years ago and trying to kill Gaddafi, and they didn't stop the U.S. from dealing, for example, with Montesinos in Peru and with other torturers in Central America. So I consider those to have honored in the breach anyway. But my broader point is really that I think they've known a lot for a long time and were able to use the tools they had. To the extent they're now wanting to add additional tools, and we can go over all of those from immigrants to new wiretapping to identity cards I've even heard talked about, I think that it's a reaction that is not necessary at this point to be able to get the terrorists. Good law enforcement is necessary, and that's what we didn't have, I think, for the last 3 years. And what you get in these kind of situations, and you had it in the First World War when, you know, they prosecuted people for espionage who protested the draft. You had it in the Second World War when they prosecuted, after the Second World War, when they prosecuted, you know, people for advocating communism. You get these huge scares, and then the government reacts with restrictions on civil liberties that are then never lifted and never changed. And so it's very worrisome, particularly when I don't think most of them are necessary. Obviously, if someone said to me, Michael, I think we can get rid of these terrorists if we do this, and I think we can, if we do this, you know, we'll be safe. I think a lot of Americans would be willing to give up certain civil liberties right now if that was a real way of tracking down and stopping terrorism. But I don't think it is, and I don't think they need the expanded powers.
Just real quick here, I should introduce again for anyone who's tuned in the last few minutes, our guest for this hour, Focus 580. We're speaking with Michael Ratner. He is an international human rights lawyer with the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City. He is also a lecturer at the Columbia School of Law in New York. And we're talking about some of the issues that people who work in the area of civil liberties have raised as we talk about making changes in law to make it, one would hope, at least the administration says, make it easier for them to investigate suspected terrorists. Questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Perhaps, as you suggest, we could talk specifically about a few things. One of the things that has been specified by Mr. Ashcroft is changes in wiretap law. What they want to do, apparently, is make it easier to get wiretaps. They want to make a wiretap something that can cross jurisdictions so that as a person moves around, you don't have to get a new wiretap every time they go in, every time they move. And apparently now they're concerned because cell phones are so easy to get and so common that rather than issuing a tap on a specific phone as we used to do when phones are more stationary, what they want to do is make it possible to get a wiretap order on a person so that no matter where that person goes and no matter what phone they may have, that then one order will cover all circumstances. What concerns you about that?
Well, I think there's two concerns. One is I think I want to make sure that that the basis on which they are able to get a wiretap order against the person is at least one that meets the standards of the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. In other words, just because, you know, Michael Ratner or X you know, knows somebody in Saudi Arabia or knows somebody in Qatar, doesn't seem to be of a sufficient reason. So one thing that concerns me is to make sure they don't loosen a standard of either probable cause or suspicion or whatever the appropriate one they're using. It's different depending on domestic whether or whether it's foreign. The second thing that's obvious concern is that a wiretap is like a vacuum cleaner, and so that if there's a wiretap on a telephone, it brings in every single conversation. My conversation with my daughter, you know, my conversation, you know, about the stock market, every single conversation, even the one we're having right now. And so that if you wiretap, if you do it on a person, that means every phone they use, whether they come to visit, you know, this person's house or that person's house or that telephone, will be picked up. And that's quite dangerous unless there's very heavy restrictions on what can be wiretapped, kite types of information. And generally, I haven't seen those vacuum cleaner type wiretaps restricted in the proper way. The other problem I have with it is, I think if you look at what happened in this last 3 or 4 years, that they may have had more information than they needed, not less. They have, you know, thousands of agents out there running around looking for terrorists for 3 years, supposedly, but they were unable to do it, and they claimed that they had too much information. They couldn't actually look at it. And so what you're going to get with widespread wiretapping like that is even more information, and it seems very unlikely to me that people are going to expose themselves on telephones. So I would tend to, while I think it's understandable that you might want to wiretap, get an order against a person, and I think they do that more or less now already, really. I don't think that's such an expansion. That doesn't seem that objectionable, but it does seem that they would have to restrict very heavily the vacuum cleaner effect of a wiretap.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation, someone listening in Urbana, so why don't we do that? They're on our line number one right here. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
I suppose I should not have been surprised to encounter an interview with the Reverend Jerry Falwell by Pat Robertson, and to hear the mentality of what I tend to call the vigilante wackos at work, and in which, among other things, Falwell explained this whole business that God visited the World Trade Center attacks upon us because of we sinned, because of gays and liberals, and he didn't put communists in the list, but he did mention the ACLU as being one of those that visited this trouble upon us. Now, everybody on the right, when they're looking for a scapegoat, is always complaining about the ACLU. I wonder if you see this as simply an aberrant strain from the wackos, or whether you see buried in this some reason why this administration, which is very conscious of the votes of the religious right, is pressing this business of extreme civil rights limitations.
Well, that's an interesting question. I think the first thing I should say about this administration, at least, while I don't agree with it on either civil liberties restrictions or on even the talk of war in the way they're doing, did come out and really essentially require Falwell to pull back his statement. And he did. I mean, it was an outrageous statement, and it's one that on our domestic front really reflects, you know, the kind of, same kind of, if not with the violence, obviously, of, you know, some fundamental religious people in other countries and other places. So it was a very extreme and bad statement. I do fear that that the administration will use this as an opportunity, even if some of it is well-intentioned, to sweep away liberties that have been dear to us and that I don't think are necessary to sweep away to fight terrorism, and to really undo a lot of what we won over, you know, 200 years of American history, and particularly what we won in the 60s and the 70s.
All right, let's go on. We have a caller in at Atlanta. I presume this is at Atlanta, Illinois, not Atlanta, Georgia. Here, line number four. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yes.
My question, hopefully not sounding like a wacko, is Homeland Defense. You know, I think too much attention is being paid to operations outside the country to avenge this terrible, terrible disaster. And of course, we have to do that. But like today, the governor thinks that, you know, we don't need to call the legislature back in to talk about security problems in the state of Illinois. And you know, I think as Americans, we might want to think a little bit of the possibilities, or a little bit like terrorists, the things that it could do. I don't think, you know, we're paying particular attention to the airline industry. While those plans have been in place, as I understand it from the news, for a long period of time, what thinks we don't have other plans in place right now that involve other aspects of transportation or other installations that, as a reprisal mode, couldn't be enacted? What is wrong with calling out the National Guard and really guarding the installations that are of real importance that could possibly be targeted? I think we're being really complacent, you know, on the local level of not doing what we could be to do to be watchful. Now, I don't think we ought to profile or target anybody or whatever. The opposite. I think we ought to draw back to those really, really installations that could cause tremendous damage to our economy and to our health, and really protect those to the nth degree. I mean, that would be relatively cheap compared to putting on a war somewhere. And I don't see, I called my representative and talked about this, and he didn't know. And some of those installations are, you know, under his control as far as being, being their representative. And he was concerned, and he said he was going to look into it. But why haven't we done that sooner? I mean, I'm going to quit.
No, I understand the point, and it's one that, you know, living in New York is particularly for us, you know, a lot of us are frightened. We have to go on with our lives normally or move, and, you know, because from what you understand, there still may be people around in the country. And they have, at least in this area, done protection of certain of the potential targets. I mean, you can't go nearly near federal buildings or federal courts. The reservoirs upstate are all closed. You know, so they have done some of that. But on the other hand, look at it another way. This is a big country, lots of bridges, tunnels everywhere. You know, it is not exactly difficult. You can't protect. You're not going to be able to do everywhere. We're going to inspect every single truck in the country. You know, much like it happened at the federal building. You know, you just can't do it. How do you do that? You can't. I don't see any way to do it. You know, if you look at the bridge, any bridge, there's like 1,000 trucks every second. You're not going to stop every truck and inspect everything. The country would grind to a total halt. So I think they've made it their priority, at least I hope they have it, as to track down what's left, if they can, of the network in the United States. And after that, we have to talk about longer term, how to prevent it longer term, whether through, you know, different kinds of policies in the world, et cetera. But I don't think, I think the suggestion, obviously, of guarding key targets is important, but I don't think it's really possible. If there's people who are going to be out to get the United States or some of its targets, it's going to be very, very hard to stop if they're still here right now.
Well, you know, we'd again, like you pointed out, we'd have to prioritize targets and stopping every truck. And you know, the loss of one bridge or one tunnel isn't necessarily going to end this country as we know it today. Obviously, you know, with the Trade Center's going down, it didn't end it.
Right.
But there is certain targets from a health reason, and the devastation that could end it. And those targets, you know, I could give you an exact number, but I'm not going to.
We don't really want to talk about that on the air, do you?
Yeah, those targets, the National Guard ought to be there.
You know, I think certain targets ought to be protected, but I just have to say that there's so many in the country that I think in the end you got to really be able to figure out how it was done and what the lapses were in our intelligence community that allowed it to happen. And then broader term, why there's so many people at this point who are really after us.
I appreciate the conversation. Thank you very
much. All right. Thank you for the call. And, of course, others are certainly welcome to call. Questions, comments, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And, again, our guest this morning in this first hour of Focus 580 is Michael Ratner. He is an international human rights lawyer with the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City. He also was a lecturer at Columbia Law School there in New York. Maybe we could talk a little bit about immigration law. Already, back a number of years back, in response to the 1993 attack on the World Trade Center, Congress passed two laws restricting the rights of immigrants. These were the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act and the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. Among other things, what one of these does is allows the INS to deport and detain people based on secret evidence. I think we can certainly expect that there at least will be proposals now to take further action to change immigration law, perhaps impose further restrictions?
Right. Actually, my office, the Center for Constitutional Rights, actually litigated a number of cases against the use of secret evidence, and some of the people who were detained on that were actually released. And what we found was pretty interesting in that case was that the secret evidence, which we eventually got revealed, actually was nothing but mere gossip and rumor, and the people weren't guilty of anything. So I still believe that you shouldn't allow a government to deal with and either punish or deport people based on secret evidence. And I think that's a very, very bad precedent. And I fear now the immigration laws because, you know, I mean, I think that the idea that you can, through tightening immigration laws, somehow prevent what happened isn't really correct. I mean, we have wide, long borders. Our border with Canada is very porous. If there's someone intent on getting into the United States, to do an evil act, they're going to be able to do it despite all the immigration laws we have in the United States, and it's also looking at this as if it's only new people coming in from outside rather than people who are currently here. So I'm not convinced that those kind of restrictions on immigration are going to help us get at the bottom of this.
Mm. I know that some people have talked about some specific things. One problem, for example, that has been pointed to, the fact that it's very difficult to do anything about people who overstay their visas.
Possible, sure.
And is there anything, though, that you think actually, looking at the law as it is, would be constructive to do, or would you say that approaching this by looking at immigration is simply not going to do anything for us in terms of dealing with terrorism?
Okay. Could we keep better track of people who are coming in? Probably. But, you know, there's so many people coming in and out of this country all the time that it's unlikely we can do that. So I am not convinced that looking at that putting more restrictions on immigrants is a way to go here. I just am not. I think as I said when I began, you know, if they knew it was bin Laden, if they knew the people in 93 who did the World Trade Center, who even threatened to do it again, and they had simply maybe stayed on that kind of issue, they didn't need all this kind of broadsword, you know, look at all immigration. I just think these broad measures are not going to be what protects our country.
Mm. Certainly people have raised questions about what's likely now to happen in terms of rights of citizens, but a particular group I think we'd have to be concerned about would be foreign nationals living in the United States.
I think that's right. I mean, obviously, one issue is civil liberties, and that has to do with, you know, what general wiretapping, identity cards, and a bunch of other things. The other is really what I would call civil rights of foreigners living in the United States. And, you know, a lot of people have been here 30, 40, 50 years and have green cards, and they're not citizens yet. And under the kinds of proposals that are coming down now, those people are going to be subject to the same kind of rules as a new person coming to the border, which doesn't make any sense to me at all. Those people are, you know, they're required to fight in our armies. They're patriotic. And to the extent we try and do that, I don't think we're going to go back to the days, I hope not, you know, of Japanese exclusion camps. And I think George Bush, President Bush, as well as Mayor Giuliani, have spoken out very strongly against going after, you know, Arab Americans, Muslims, South Asians. I think that has to be reemphasized. But I hope we don't even do lesser restrictions on people of particular populations.
Yeah, it's interesting to note, again, thinking about that at the time, while perhaps quite rightly we've changed the way we think about that, at the time there was strong support for the action of the government to intern Japanese Americans. It was even upheld by the Supreme Court in 1944.
By even some of the most liberal judges we had, Justice Douglas, for example. And it was only recently that we've looked back on that and said that was appalling. So you have to be very concerned at these kind of moments that people, in their anger and sorrow, which we all feel in particular, I mean, all over the country and in New York, I think we're still going through, post-traumatic stress syndrome of some sort and being very depressed on many, many days, that you can't let that rule how we react to this. And that's what I fear. New York, for example, New York State just went through and passed emergency anti-terrorism legislation both with regard to creating a bunch of new crimes and wiretapping. Well, it doesn't seem to me that we had all of that in place before. It's sort of done out of, you know, anger and sorrow, and those things, those laws, those new laws will be with us forever. And it's going to be, obviously it's going to be a changed America, but I'd rather not see it changed in a way that really hurts the freedom that that's so important to all of us.
We have a number of callers. In fact, the lines are full, so we'll continue to talk with people who are listening. The next is in Belgium, Illinois, here, line number four. Hello.
Hello. Maybe I have a naive point of view here, but it seems to me we could save ourselves a whole lot of trouble all the way around, including the destruction of New York property last week, if we would have just taken a much more even-handed and more honest merchant type of approach to all of our dealings with all countries, whether they're Muslim or Christian or whatever. We wouldn't have to be infringing upon our own civil rights then.
No, I don't think that's a naive view at all. I think even in the short term, but certainly in the long term, that has come out of some commentators, even on some major media. I think David Wooten on ABC said something about how a more even-handed position in the Mideast, and particularly with Israel and Palestine. Not that I'm not clear that it'll end everything, but I think it would go a long way toward having the U.S. be more even-handed in its dealings, I mean, particularly at this point in the Mideast, but throughout the world. And by even-handed, I mean, let's take an example, and obviously it wouldn't have necessarily stopped this, but the fact that the Bush administration took a hands-off view as to what was going on in Israel and Palestine in the first few months of its administration was very bad. The fact that, you know, Israel is in control of a bunch of Islamic holy sites, not great. Not that I'm saying, you know, you don't have people out there who are going to do evil no matter what, but I think the caller's suggestion, we can, you know, people can look at that as to what might have to change, but I think that's certainly one of them. Even the Times had an article on Sunday, on a front-page article saying that, look, as long as we allow conflicts to just simmer in the world for year after year, it's going to create terrorists. As long as there's a world that is so unequal, it's going to create people who hate the United States. Now, you know, obviously, as I said, there'll still be people, but I think that the caller's point is very well taken.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Let's go to Chicago, line one. Hello.
Yeah. How you doing this morning, Jim?
Fine. Good.
Good. You know, I agree with the last caller that you must have a balanced policy, whether you're dealing in the Middle East or where. We are supporting a lot of governments that we shouldn't be supporting, and I understand the hatred that the people have against us, and much of it is justified. It really hurt me to see the jetliners, you know, I mean, those airplanes go into the Trade Center. I mean, New York is, you know, it's my country, so I cry when I see this. You know, it really hurt, but I understood it. My problem is, I heard the gentleman say that the borders are porous, but if you looked from last Tuesday to right now, you can't even get a net in and out of this country unless they wanted to get out. You know, so we can control our borders, and we do have to do something about our immigration law. Some of these guys were here and had no business being here. You know, I mean, how do you, you know, ACLU, how do you respond to that?
Well, here's the question. I think when I say porous, I mean you got a long border and you don't have to go through checkpoints to get into this country. Canada is just, you know, everybody admits it, that you can just get through. The second thing is a lot of people will come through immigration that they can't figure out who they are. I mean, not can't figure out, but they can certainly hide. I mean, even some of these people, you know, I don't know the history of each one of them, but, you know, whether they were middle class, you know, came out of places that you wouldn't suspect them of being terrorists. So I think that's a very I think it's a very hard way to go to try and stop terrorism through that. I think it's obviously one way to look at it and try and do better on how we look at who comes in. But I just don't think it's going to be the answer to it all.
But I think we must deal with that. You know, my brother went to Canada once, and he went to Canada. They asked him how long was he going to be in Canada, what's he going to be employed. And you know what they did to him? They put him on the plane. After he responded negatively, he was just there visiting or what have you. They put him on the plane and they sent him back home because obviously they thought that maybe he was not coming in the country to do the right thing. Not that he's a criminal, none of that, you know. But he was, escorted right to the next exit out.
Yeah, I
have to do that.
I think two things. One is a lot of people are going to get through even with those questions,
right?
Because they don't have backgrounds like none of these. I don't know how many of the people who actually piloted those planes had any kind of background that would have tipped off immigration. And secondly, as I said, a lot of the people don't have to come through immigration.
Right. But anyway, I just said God bless America, and we got to get through this thing, you know, because we are all in this thing together. If you're an American, you are in this thing together, and we got to move
forward. Not just American, you know. What was it? 61 countries lost people in the World Trade Center.
Right.
Yeah.
All right, God bless
so
you.
So it's a worldwide thing, what happened here. And while it's against the United States, it affects us all.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here. Again, I should introduce our guest. We're speaking with Michael Ratner. He is an international human rights lawyer with the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City. He also teaches he's a lecturer at Columbia School of Law in New York, and we're trying in this part of Focus 580 to explore some of the implications for civil rights as we talk about what changes in law might be made to try to give the government the tools to investigate and prevent acts of terrorism. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Just maybe one quick question. I'm going to get back to some other people who are calling because you have raised it, and I have seen it raised in some of the articles that I have read, and that's the subject of identity cards. Apparently, there are a number of places around the world where people are required to carry them. Here, in one article I have, this happened to be from the Wall Street Journal that explored this, noted the fact that in Belgium, China, France, the Netherlands, and Spain, people are required to carry ID cards. In Japan, apparently, foreigners are required to carry alien registration cards. And I guess that some people now are at least raising the question, would something like that be appropriate for the United States?
Well, I guess here aliens do need to have alien registration cards, or else if you get stopped, you don't have it. You've got to find it. But my thinking about that goes back a little bit to, Germany requires it also, although they didn't mention that in the list of countries. And had probably the strictest law. You have to, when you go from one house to another, you have to register at the police station, you have to have an identity card, et cetera. And Germany had some of the worst waves of terrorism we know in the 70s, late 60s, 70s, the Bader-Meinhof gang and others. So the fact that one has an identity card, I don't think is a way to stop terrorism. I mean, this country is too big, too many people. People can get false identity cards by coming in on false papers or being, in any other way. And then if they have a real identity card, they can go commit acts of terrorism. So I think it's basically trying to get at something that's an extremely serious matter, but it's too much of what I would call a scattergun approach to do it, and I don't think it'll be effective at all. I again want to go back to what I think is going to be effective now are a few things. One is tracking down with the best criminal resources we have the people in the United States and abroad who did this particular act. Secondly, continuing to do that with people who might be planning particular acts. And thirdly is really forming a coalition with people around the world, including the UN, countries around the world, to try and stop terrorism. And lastly, and I think one caller said it, is to begin to look at what kind of policies in the world have caused people to be so angry and hate the United States so much.
We'll continue. We'll go on next to another caller, and this is a person in Champaign. It's line two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. How are you?
Good.
I just wanted to say that I think you're exactly right when you talk about the identity card solution, for lack of a better word, as being anything but anyone who's ever got a fake ID card to go drinking underage or has seen the numerous, and I've seen myself, plenty of illegal aliens with pretty good green cards that work in all of the government offices in this state and others. I think it's just, today's level of technology will eliminate any possibility that an identity card system will work. An earlier caller said, I think the answer lies in changing our foreign policy to a certain extent. And I'd like to second that opinion because as disturbing as the whole incident was, I found equally disturbing the sights of Palestinians handing out sweets to people on the street and celebrating the loss of American life, of any life. And until we can get the international community together to just agree that any terrorist action anywhere is unacceptable, then this will just continue. And my question is given the direction of the discussion about civil liberties that the government is having, I think Attorney General General Ashcroft mentioned today that we would be detaining some illegal immigrants for 24 to 48 to any necessary amount of time. I think it was, I'm paraphrasing, but that kind of sort of policy change is very frightening, given the already extraordinary powers that some groups like the ATF squads have to just sort of, on a gut feeling or instinct, arrest people, seize their property, and these people, citizens, leave alone immigrants, have no legal recourse during or after their property is seized or anything, or destroyed or damaged. And I'm wondering what Mr. Ratner would have to say about that. Thanks.
Well, I think the Ashcroft proposals, you know, generally it is required that 24 to 48 hours, after 24 or 48 hours, you have to really come up with a legitimate reason for detaining somebody. At the same time, there has been a number of immigrants in the United States who have been detained indefinitely, such as, for example, someone from Cuba who then committed a crime in the United States and isn't permitted, Cuba won't take them back. The Supreme Court essentially held that illegal last summer, that indefinite detention, which is something every group in the United States has complained about in other countries, is something that the United States Constitution, at least according to the Supreme Court, probably shouldn't allow. On the other hand, in this kind of crisis, I'm worried about what the courts will say on something like that. It does seem to me that if you don't have evidence about somebody that permits you to keep them in jail, if they're not, whatever that standard of evidence is, and a trial after that, that you should not be able to keep people indefinitely in prison based on essentially the whim of the jailer or the government. That would smack at really a central issue of our country's liberty.
One of the things that we have been told is that a number of people have been arrested as material witnesses, not because they are suspected of committing crimes themselves, but because the government believes that they might have information that would assist in the investigation of the crime. What exactly does the law say about what you can do there?
Material witness arrests are permitted, but you also have to prove that there's a risk of flight of the witness. In other words, if you or I were a material witness to a crime, if I saw some, you know, guy rob the bank next door to me, they couldn't really arrest me unless there was a substantial chance of flight. So presumably, and of course you don't know about this, that those people are people who somehow have some evidence of what happened on September 11th and are also risks of flight. And you can keep those people in jail, you know, for a fair amount of time, but you can't keep them in forever. Obviously, keep them in until either there's no risk of flight or until, you know, you've concluded the trial. Frequently, a material witness is simply another way of saying this person is, sometimes it can be, this is a suspect, but we don't have enough to hold them as a suspect yet. We don't know if they were actually involved, but they might have evidence that we want, and sometimes an excuse for a suspect, for holding a suspect without probable cause.
The next caller is on our line number 3. This is also Champagne. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I had a couple of questions. I apologize. I am tuning in late if you dealt with these already.
That's okay.
I'm very happy that our country has come together over this, but I'm concerned because we have a history of sort of moving from patriotism to this sort of jingoistic attitude, this very hyper-military, hyper-nationalistic state where other points of view are not taken into account. And I've already seen that talking to some people when I say I'm concerned that my government is going to go too far and I don't have confidence in my government. I've been told that I'm not a patriot, so on and so forth. I could see this really happening. I'm wondering, as a citizen, what are the most efficient ways that I can get my views across to the government directly at any level? I mean, I've heard that signing these online petitions is maybe not as effective as other methods and snail mail versus email. What's the best way to get the voice heard?
Well, I think that's a very good question. First, I think your point is right that, you know, and one thing that's disturbing to me is that the rhetoric that's coming out of our leaders in Washington, not necessarily their actions yet, but the rhetoric is very bad. When I hear them talk about this as an act of war and not as an act of terrorism, and I hear them say things like, you know, we've just got to essentially imply that we're going to do massive bombing. And when I hear that reinforced by the media that uses things like, you know, we have to turn Afghanistan into a basketball court, that's very worrisome because on the first level, I'm not sure they know who to hit or how to hit and that they should probably treat this as a criminal act and not a and not as an attack of terrorism, and try and get the arrest the people, et cetera, and not go to war over this.
Mm-hmm.
Although, if obviously this is a country behind us, then they have to do something. But on the second level, what I think signing online petitions is important. I think you can do it. It's an easy act. I think getting a hold of your member of Congress and telling them, look, this is horrible. We want to get these people, but we don't think it's worth risking a war at this point when we don't even know who did it, how it was done, et cetera. And let's take it easier and really get the people who did it. Let's do something constructive. So I think getting a hold of your member of Congress is important.
Mm-hmm.
I think going to, and maybe in New York it actually seems somewhat easier in the rest of the country. There seems to be more, dissent isn't the right word because people are obviously very upset, but the last vigil I went to in New York had people there who had signs that said, don't go after the Islamic religion, don't go after Arab Americans, don't make a war, do track down the people. So I think going to the extent you can do that, and there's one place that people like you can do that, go to a place and actually put out a leaflet or at least articulate that view. I think it's very important. I think talk shows like this to get your point of view across, to make the country not look like it's just one group of people who only want to just bomb people into the world, which is actually very dangerous because, already the gulf between the United States and certain elements of the world is already very wide. An indiscriminate bombing will widen that more and, in my view, create more terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
So I think your calling in is very important, for example, but I think you have to get groups of people to do that and get that word out.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. We have about 10 minutes left, actually less, in this part of Focus 580. I want to introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Michael Ratner from the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. He's an international human rights lawyer. He's also a lecturer at Columbia School of Law in New York. We're talking about some of the civil liberties issues raised as we talk about how in law we might respond to the threat of terrorism. And we have a number of callers. We'll try to get in as many as we can in the time that remains. We'll go on next to a caller down in southern Illinois. They're next in line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Yes?
Yes.
Okay. Well, my view is that I am an immigrant. I'm from another country and came a long time ago. I'm an old lady, and I'm married to a Kentuckian. That's the funny combination. And my children were born in Kentucky. I have grandchildren. I came through an education program. There was a shortage of teachers here. And I have been told, go home. I have been crosses burned out outside of my home. I didn't even know what that meant when a cross was burned out outside.
It was burned outside your house?
What?
Cross is burned outside your house?
Outside of my home, a big cross burned.
Well, that's an awful, awful story.
Yep. And what surprises me is that we train soldiers to go to other countries and kill women, innocent women and children. Timothy McBain, is one example. He did it, and he became a bitter man, and he did it here to us. To our people, to our children, that was terrible. I mean, pretty much what was. How do we even know that it's a Timothy McBain that did all this? I know there is going to be violation of civil rights. There is no way that we can avoid it. But all these things that's going on. USA, USA, God bless America. It's like a football game. And God bless America. Why don't we say God bless the world? And let's all get together and let's see what's going on. What are we doing? What are we doing wrong? Are we shutting our doors? Are we keeping ourselves inside of a little, what you call cocoon? We are not looking outside. We are not looking what's going on.
I mean, I think the first thing you said is really a number of things, but the first thing you said was really crucial, that people like you should not be attacked. I mean, you are, a citizen of this country, whether you're an immigrant or a citizen or whatever. You're living here. You obviously, no one in this country supported what happened there. And what gets me is the kind of rhetoric coming out of Washington, which basically says, war, go attack, is almost the international equivalent of domestically attacking people who had nothing to do with this but are being attacked because of their ethnicity. And that's very, very bad, and it has to be absolutely condemned. As far as who did this, you know, the evidence, you know, I obviously don't know, but the evidence is fairly strong at this point that it wasn't, you know, a McVeigh American, that it was probably someone from out, that it looks like it was people from outside the country and maybe from the Mideast. But the third point you're making, I think, is one that we've repeated here a few times, is while I don't, you know, I can't say I blame, I'm not going to put the responsibility for this on the United States, because the people who did this were obviously evil criminals and should be brought to justice. But I do think the kinds of policy of whether it was the bombing of the pharmaceutical plant of in Sudan, or whether it was the embargo that's been going on for years of Iraq, or whether it's the U.S. tilting to one side in the Mideast, in Palestinian-Israel politics for sure, is the kind of breeding ground that creates terrorists like this. And that I think the U.S. does have to look at itself and say, well, how can we get together with the world so that we have a more equitable world, that people, that everybody agrees that these things shouldn't happen, and secondly, that less people are willed to do it.
We have about a minute or two left, and I want to try to get at least one more caller. Let's go to Champagne, line two. Hello.
Hi. Let me be very brief and let you respond, since you've already talked about the war, which I was going to raise, that it seems to be treated as a war rather than as a criminal issue. But then there's this new talk about having assassinations as part of war, and also that of redefining war so it's not a matter of war against a nation, but war against a terrorist organization or organizations, against a whole bunch of them, and seeing it as a multinational war. So maybe you want to talk about that.
Well, I think that I really think I found it incredibly painful as well as dangerous to talk about this as a war. And then the resolution that was given by Congress, which essentially says the president can make war without any time limits and without any oversight by Congress and without any restrictions on any nation, organization, or person, I find to be giving over the authority of the people of the United States through their Congress to one man, and I find that extremely, extremely dangerous. I think this should be handled as a criminal matter, as a terrorist matter, in which we track down and prosecute and stop the people who are doing it, and not as something as war. Now, that being said, I think at least the first steps by the United States, which is to say demanding, assuming it's bin Laden, that they have evidence against, demanding that Afghanistan turn him over is the right first step. It's not a war step. I think pulling together a coalition of countries is very important. I think going to the UN, which I hope the U.S. does, is very important. So, for example, I think Afghanistan, if they got a demand from the UN, might treat that differently. Might, I said. So I think that the war talk is very, very dangerous and probably unnecessary, particularly because I don't think it's going to help end terrorism, but I think it's going to actually make it worse.
There, we'll have to stop for this hour. We want to say, Mr. Ratner, thanks very much for giving us your time. We certainly do appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Michael Ratner, international human rights lawyer with the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. Our program, Focus 580, is made possible in part by support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Our show, Focus 580, also made possible by a grant from the massage therapy professionals at Bodywork Associates of Champaign. Bodywork has been providing practical relief for tired, aching muscles since 1982. We're continuing to try to give some avenues for discussion of these issues, and one way we're doing that is on our WI Law website. We've set up a community web discussion board for you to share your thoughts and reactions. You can log on to WI Law's web board from our homepage at will.uiuc.edu. In the next hour, we're going to talk about intelligence gathering. James Bamford will be our guest. He's an investigative reporter who's written a book that looks at the history of the National Security Agency. So I hope you can stay with us. Right now, a break for an update on the markets.